session number 122 on Fiverr or two.
Mr. Alfred Cameron, Reel 2.
We started bombing at dawn the next day. And the Lysander could carry a variety of bombs. Sometimes we had 4 50-pounders, or sometimes we had 2 250-pounders. And we just took what was next on the list and took off. We always had a fitter or a bombardier sergeant in the back, because they would pay extra money for flying. They didn't have a machine gun, but they just came for the trip. I forget the name of the village we were after, but it was about 50 miles along the south of Afghanistan. And among ourselves, we agreed on a kitty. And every pilot who did a trip put a rupee into the kitty. And the kitty went to whoever first bombed the headman's house. The village was mud-walled, surrounded, huts inside it. Empty, of course, by this time. But there was one tall house, like a small church. That was both a scout lookout and the headman's house. But we were surrounded by mountains, and you couldn't come too low for your bombing because you had to pull out. So we found it wise to release bombs, but not lower than 2,000 feet, perhaps 3,000 feet. Because your pullout afterwards had to clear the mountaintops all around about. So it was my first trip, and I was quite excited. And the dawn bombs went off, and I hadn't hit the headman's house. So we turned for home, and I thought, in this wild and lonely country, how marvellous to do low flying all the way home. Low flying is a great temptation for pilots. Partly, I think, because it's the only time you get any sensation of speed. You've no sensation high up in the air of speed. But low flying, yes. So I can ride down to about 15 feet in an old riverbed. And thumbs up from my sergeant gunner in the back. And then I realised that the banks of this dried up river were above the level of the wings. And any of these tribesmen who cared to could be there with his rifle. Every man carries a gun. And if they lie down on the ground, they're impossible to see, because there's no greenery. Everything's just a shale, grey, brown, dust, stones. And I thought, we are setting targets for anybody up there who cares to pop us. And I never did low flying again in that area. Never. And within a year, another section of our squadron had to go up for ops. And they potted one of our flight commanders that way. He was going to low fly all the way home. And I don't know what they hit, but they brought him down, and he was, well, they captured him and they tortured him and murdered him, which was a regular procedure. So it crossed my mind, with the grace of God, that was a stupid thing to do. I never did it again.
How much chance do you think there was of being brought down?
Quite a chance, because at that close range, they couldn't miss. And even if they missed you, they could hit a petrol pipe or something like that. And you've had it. And that's what happened with the flight commander later. They didn't get a bullet in him, but they fractured something vital in his engine. And he crash-landed. Badly. And his air gun in the back was thrown out and killed. But he was captured. But that was 6 or 8 months later on other ops.
What did you think of the bombing of the Pathan villages? Did you think it was fair game?
It was like shooting fish in a barrel, I thought. But this was the procedure. When I asked questions about it in the evening, you know, I found this was a regular thing, gone on for years. They get the leaflets warning them, and the bombing goes in as agreed. They have vacated the village and gone to their relatives 5 miles up the road, next village. Just accepted it. That was the job, what we were told to do. And it was my first experience of ops, so boy, oh boy, let's go.
What did you think the attitude of the Pathans was to it? Do you think they thought it was legitimate?
Probably they didn't, because they did nasty things to you if you were captured, if you force landed. And they had always done so. There's talk of bullet chitties. But we were never issued with any. This was a leaflet in Pushtu, which you were supposed to hand over if you were captured, which said, in return for this person being sent back, brought back to wherever, Miranshah in our case, a sum of, I think it was 200 rupees or something like that, would be paid to them. Now, there were days when this was sewn into people's jackets. The Americans used to have it going over the hump to Chungking from northeast India in case they were captured by the Nagar headsmen, tidesmen and so on. Bullet chitties were never issued to us. we never thought to ask for them.
So there was no demand for them. What do you remember about your next operation?
I did several ops at Miranshah. And then we were recalled to Peshawar. I don't know why. And when we got back to Peshawar, there was a signal from Delhi saying that our sister squadron, 28 squadron, also army cooperation, had been chased out of Burma by the Japs and lost all their gear and were being re-equipped on the eastern side of India in Ranchi, the capital of Bihar state. And they needed two pilots to make up the complement. And they wanted two sent from 20 squadron. So the squadron leader had said, right, last in, first out. So when we came back from Miranshah, a new boy had just arrived from training school at Ambala. I remember him there. So he was now on strength, and the last in before him was myself. So obviously we were due to join 28 Squadron and take two aeroplanes with us.
Can you tell me about the move?
Well, we had to take two Lysanders off the strength of 20 Squadron and fly them to Ranchi in Bihar, and they would then go on the strength of 28 Squadron. So I was the senior one in charge. We were both sergeants, Bennett was the other fellow. So I thought, right, maps. And I went to my flight commander. Oh, he said, no maps from here. But not, I said, I'll guarantee pushing it. No maps go out of here. Maps are very scarce, of course, in those days. You couldn't buy them anywhere. And they were very precious. And we had good maps. But he wasn't parting with them. And I, strangely, or normally at the time, I felt, well, I like the fellow, much respect for him. And it only crossed my mind once, and he's missed it, to go over his head and go to the squadron leader, which I think I should have done. He's the one who's issuing the instructions, and I should have asked for the maps. But India was easy to fly over in good weather if you knew where you were. Now, all the Delhi area, right up to Lahore, we knew by heart, and you couldn't miss. If the weather didn't clamp down in you, if the weather stayed good, you couldn't miss, because there was only one railway line, there was only one main road, and it went from Peshawar down to Lahore and on to Delhi, right across India to Kolkata, and the big gauge railway line, you couldn't miss that. That did the same. And I wasn't bothered about reaching Delhi. It was beyond Delhi I was troubled about, because I'd never flown over that country. So I thought, oh well, maybe get some maps in Delhi, because we had to refuel there. So the two of us got to Delhi, and it found the Delhi airport had now been converted into a large service unit and was hotching with RAF technicians, who weren't very happy with the heat and the Russians and quarters and so on. And when I mentioned the flight sergeant maps, he said, oh, nothing to do with me. So I thought, there's going to be no hope. I went into town, and of course you couldn't buy maps anywhere. So I asked the station commander, who was a wing commander engineer, a regular in the RAF. And he laughed his head off. He says, there's no maps here, there's no maps in the station. But along the wall above the mantelpiece in his office, there was a huge map covering the whole of the north of India, right from the Burmese border, right to Afghanistan. And I said, well, could I take a section of that? And he exploded. No way. The map wasn't leaving the wall. So I asked if I could measure it and set my course off it. And he said, yes, could do that, but the map didn't come off the wall. So I did that, and that's how we set out.
Did you get there all right?
No. Bennett, I think, had been horrified at the thought of flying across India with no maps. And I thought, by this time I was getting thoroughly cheesed off of this Air Force. And I thought, well, I had my worldly goods in the back seat with no passengers. I had two large boxes of kit stuffed down the back fuselage. And I knew the safe flying time of a Lysander was 2 hours 20 minutes. You could maybe extend that a bit if you hadn't been throwing it about a lot and wasting petrol. So I said to Bennett, well, we'll give it 2 hours 20 minutes, and if there's no Ranchi in sight, we'll put it down. India's pretty flat until you come to the Himalayas. I said, well, easy, get it down. I think he had been horrified with such a thought. But I felt bad about this business of not being given maps and sent away with two aircraft. I did. I thought it was grossly irresponsible. So I thought, right. So 2 hours, 20... Oh, no, long before we reached the 2 hours, 20 minutes, we'd only been going about less than half an hour. When Bennett flew over beside me, waggled his wings and pointed down. So we had no intercom in India. The atmospherics were against the fineness of wireless sets and all that. So we could only communicate by hand signals and so on. So he waggled his wings, pointed down, and I presumed he'd engine trouble. So I watched him, and there was a cantonment down below, a small town, and the roundabout was just semi-desert. Bags are flat. So I thought, well, he'll get down there all right. Good luck to him. So I just carried on. Actually, what he did was, it was an army station, and there was a parade ground in the middle of the cantonment, and he tried to put the Lysander down on the parade ground, which of course is far too small to take an aeroplane. So he roared across it, never touched the ground, but he was determined to put it down. So he ran out of parade ground. He swiped the palm trees and the edge of the road. Then, when you have these single roads in India, when the monsoon comes, there's got to be drains to take the excessive water. And normally, at both sides of a main road, there's a deep nullah, a ditch, maybe 6, 8, 10 feet deep, depending on how strong the floods are. So he'd had a nullah on both sides of the road, which went down the side of the parade ground. So he took the trees with him, and then he went in the nullah, and that took his undercarriage off. And he himself had two broken legs, and I don't know what other injuries. And we never heard of him again. I didn't know this till afterwards. So I carried on, 2 hours, 20 minutes, and there was no sign of an aerodrome. So I thought, well, I'm not going to bother. If RAF's not bothered, I'm not bothered. So I put the thing down on open ground. And there was nobody in sight when I put it down. And within half an hour, there were 3,000 people there. Far and wide. There was a bungalow about a quarter of a mile away. And that turned out to be the residence of the local station master and his wife. He was an Anglo-Indian, very nice chap, very nice couple. So he came over, and got my gear lifted out and said, oh, well, I must stay with them until things were sorted out. So got permission to use their phone and got through to 28th Squadron. This was a Saturday. And I found the only chap on duty was the corporal in the orderly room who was answering the phone. The squadron leader was getting married in Ranchi, and the whole squadron had gone to the wedding. So I gave my particulars, where I was, and I thought, right, we'll sit tight until we're rescued. So the station master and his wife were most hospitable, and we had a great evening. A comfortable bed, shower next morning and breakfast. And then we just sat in the veranda. And about 11 o'clock, RAF transport arrived. And that was how I joined 28th Squadron.
They arrived with some fuel for you?
Oh no, the thing wouldn't go off again. I landed on rough ground. I mean, it was open and flat. There was only a few goats about. But no way could you take it off. Actually, what I hadn't seen, I landed in the wind, I'd all that worked out. What I hadn't seen was, there was a drop. Because the two who arrived were the disciplined warrant officer from 28th Squadron and a sergeant engineer who turned out to be this bloke Wright, who later years built Air Anglia. That's when we first met. And the warrantor was a seasoned old soldier. Warrantor was a... And he walked around, had a look at it, And he said, how do you manage to get down there? And I said, no problem. He said, have you seen what's in front of you? And I said, no. So there was a drop of about 4 feet, or about 20 feet in front of where I finished off. The land dropped. Paddy fields, they build them up and then they fill them with water. But then there are different levels. And I had never seen this from the air, never appreciated that. So I was very fortunate. All that was dented was one of the wing slats in the branches of a date palm. That was all.
So did it mean the plane was just lost?
No, no, no. They took it to bits. They got what we call a Queen Mary, which is a long, low loader, motor transport, and they put it onto that, and they brought it back to Ranchi. And 3 weeks later, the thing flew.
How did your journey continue from Ranchi to the war zone in Burma?
Well, at Ranchi, we found India Command were assembling a vast conglomeration of troops which were destined in some way or another to go back into Burma eventually. So our air room was just a strip of tarmac surrounded by grass. And the officers had buildings somewhere in Ranchi town. The other ranks lived in tents in a mango orchard out in the country. And it was very pleasant, and the food was bearable. There was a war on, and we quite enjoyed it. At the foot of our road, where it joined the, not the major road, but a more important road, there was then a huge plain, and there were some army tents there. Within a year, that plain was filled with army, Indian and British. There must have been about 30,000 there. There was a vast mass of tents within 12 months. And then things were getting sorted out about going back into Burma. We flew Lysanders for 9 months, and then we were equipped with Hurricanes. And we did army cooperation work with the army, gunnery practice, spotting and so on. Did night flying. And then in the beginning of 43, the first moves were made, and the army, Indian and British, with a third of our squadron, one flight, moved down the Arakan, the sea coast, towards Akiab, Chittagong, Cox's Bazar, Akiab, and so on. And Japs, of course, opposition all the way. A second flight remained at Ranchi, and the third flight went to Imphal, right in the northeast corner of India, just below Kohima. So I landed for Imphal when my turn came. We took turns. We'd go up one at a time for maybe a couple of months and come back, somebody else would go up. Likewise, going down the coast. So when the first flight went off, that was to go with the army down the Arakan. We were all, you know, keyed up and things are moving at last and so on and so forth. And 48 hours later, the news came through that one of our flight sergeants had been shot down the very first day they were there. Germany Zero Dawn Patrol. He was a South African farmer, this lad, and well-built lad, very good pilot. And he'd gone out as a number two to the flight commander. Number two follows number one, guards his tail. And they never saw the Japs. They come out the sun. And the most difficult shot of all is a full beam deflection shot. You come in this way. And that's the most difficult one of all. And he took him straight through the middle, took his head off. And John had his machine trimmed, as you should have, so that if you need your hands for anything, take your hands off, it'll fly itself. And John had his trimmed. So they blew his head off, and the machine carried on flying, and eventually flew into the beach and landed. But he had no head. So that kind of shook things up when the news came back. And we found this war is for real.
How did you find the Hurricane to fly?
Fine. Good.
After the Lysander?
Oh yes, much faster. Different kettle of fish altogether. You felt you had a weapon. The Lysander was, okay, a sturdy old horse. But useless for armed combat. Absolutely useless. But all right for Ops and Waziristan, yes, great. But useless on the eastern side, absolutely. You'd have been a sitting duck.
But did you like flying the Hurricane?
Very much, yeah.
Anything you didn't like about it?
No, it wasn't a vicious machine. It had no hidden nasty tricks. And you know when a machine's going to stall, you know by the seat of your pants, there's something wrong with your airspeed. But there was a training machine called a Harvard, a great thing in America. Eventually we got them out east. And we were warned with them, but then you should never be in the position where you stall it. But you always stall a machine to begin with. The first thing you do when you go up in a plane is to stall it, to see what happens, so that you know if you're caught out what to do. But the Harvard, when it stalled, flicked like lightning, straight over. Just in 1 second, twisted right over. Others would kind of dip a wing and then roll. The Hurricane was like that. But the Harvard used to nick like that, but then you should never be in that position anyway, because you know from the feel of it. So the Hurricane had no tricks like that.
So you went with one flight up to Imphal?
Yes.
Which month was that?
Oh, maybe March, April 43, something like that.
42?
No. 41.